KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Art Spiegelman joins us to talk about his seminal work Before Mouse as he takes us back in his most recent collection, Breakdowns, to his life and work as an underground comics cartoonist before cartooning was considered respectable or cartoonists were willing to call themselves artists. We'll talk with him all about his artistry and what he describes as living in the shadow of Mouse, the work that made him internationally famous. Art Spiegelman on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Art Spiegelman was mad about cartooning. As a boy, he devoured the likes of Mad Magazine and Little Lulu and the Sunday Funnies before he became the internationally celebrated creator of the 1992 Pulitzer Prize-winning personal family memoir, The Holocaust Mouse. He was an underground comic writer, editing underground comic magazines like Raw and Arcade and creating innovative and memorable work that has recently been brought back in a collection called Breakdowns. Known as the creator for Tops of Wacky Packages and Garbage Pail Kids and the author of In the Shadow of the No Tower, he was also for a decade a New Yorker staff artist and writer, and he joins us in the studio for this hour of Forum. And welcome back. Good morning.
It's great to be back, Mike. Hi.
I think this is maybe, other than sleeping, this is the only hour that you go without smoking a cigarette. Would that be true? Well, you know, it was a trip, as they used to say back in the day, going past these memories with Breakdowns. And what I wanted to call attention to initially was how you said there was even a taboo about calling yourself an artist. Before we had graphic artists, before we cartoons were deemed to be artists or given that kind of cachet, at one point, in fact, you call yourself a small businessman, which is pretty funny. But the idea that a cartoonist was not an artist was sacrosanct, the idea of artists. Huh?
Yeah, I think, there's a number of ways I could enter into this thing, but the center of it is just cartooning was always kind of lowbrow, and it was on the low side of that high-low divide. And when I was out here in San Francisco working on underground comics, we were proud lowbrow cartoon workers of the world and an adjunct to the IWW, literally. You know,
like you said, like a plumber, you saw.
Yeah. In fact, like when you're trying to pick up women before underground comics, you couldn't say in a bar, "Oh yeah, I draw comics," because that was a surefire no win. And on the other hand, if you said you were a carpenter, that somehow seemed, if not saintly, at least cool.
At least it had a blue collar cachet to it.
Yeah, it did. And then among the comics artists that I admired and respected was a junior or a freshman among seniors in the underground comic scene, people like Crumb and S. Clay Wilson in Spain. Some of them, like S. Clay Wilson, went to art school, but he wouldn't cop to it, you know? It was really about you could make something that somebody else could look over your shoulder and say, "Hey, man, that's art." But the comics were growing out of that Popeye newsprint universe, and it wasn't okay to treat that piece of newsprint as if it were a canvas with the fine art on it. And when my comics changed from being kind of imitative of the Zap Comics crowd to finding my own voice, that did involve doing this kind of genuinely unseemly thing, declaring, "I'm an artist. I want to put my thoughts and feelings on paper and use the same kind of means that a serious writer or a serious painter would." That was the one thing that got me in trouble with my gang of unflappable other cartoonists, in a sense.
Many of them out here. I mean, you, in fact,
we're
out here, and I want to talk about that era. But first, you're talking about your development, your metamorphosis in terms of becoming an artist and becoming a storyteller. When you started, there's a story, in fact, in your book about Crumb's wife kicking you, barring you from the house because you were doing something that was so outrageous. It was as if you had to be outrageous or had to shock. And then suddenly you realize, no, the personal revelatory stuff is really where I belong, I guess.
It's certainly what opened me up to finding my own voice after starting to do comics as a 10-year-old, being published at 15, doing underground comics from the time I was about 17 till 20, at least 22, before I found my own way of doing it. At that point, the outrage was the pleasure of making comics was, let's dismantle everything the comic code of America ever put down as a rule for what would make an acceptable comic. But that personal comics was something quite new that entered in the underground comics moment. A cartoonist named Justin Green did a book called Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary, and he turned each of those comics panels into like little confession booths to relive his obsessive-compulsive psychosexual disorders growing up Catholic. And that was a revelation for me and for a lot of cartoonists, including Crumb, in terms of making that comic stuff more personal.
Oh boy, you put it out there. I mean, early on, you're writing about getting called all these names because you were missing balls out in the outfield or swinging at the bat, at the plate and missing balls. And then it moves into your mother's death, your mother's suicide, and your own breakdown, as the title suggests. I mean, this is stuff that really goes deep in the marrow.
Well, as it says in that little sequence where I'm playing baseball as a kid and it's kind of humiliating, it says, forged in the crucible of humiliation and trauma, cartoonists are made, not born. So that material that you were just referring to are sort of like wormholes of memory that come out of that book from the 70s, looking back at what I was making then and seeing what memories were like kind of ignited, and making an introduction in comics form that's like half as long as the book that follows, like 40-page book, 20-page introduction in comics format, that were the memories that formed that portrait of the artist of the young blankety blank and his thoughts.
Yeah, so, I was wondering, how do we say blankety blank? Well, you just did it.
I just did, because otherwise it's percentage, arabat, squiggle, star, exclamation point.
That's always in cartoons, those kind of
Well, that's
things.
Why I used it, because it's cartoon language. It can't be said, it can only be seen.
It's a nice thing about cartoons, one of the many nice things about cartoons, although we were talking about aphorisms and metaphors last week with a guest who was on here, and statements that are memorable. You got one from Chick Young here. It's interesting in a dull, monotonous sort of way to be a cartoonist. That's the guy who gave us Blondie, Dagwood and Blondie. Chick
right,
Young, yeah.
Right.
And there's a lot of rich stuff and rich material here, including for those local folks who remember that era of Haight-Ashbury and remember Bill Griffith and Crumb being out here and all that talent that was here. I mean, it was like, in some ways, it's sort of like the Beat Movement many respects, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly like there's this kind of family tree that goes back to from Bohemians to Beats to hippies to punks that's like been always like a central chord in the San Francisco cultural life. But for me at the time, maybe it was just like the romanticism of wanting to become the artiste. I thought of it as like Paris in the 20s or something.
Well, when you go back and meet this former self of yours, I mean, you say there are things you admire, there are things you are appalled by, all that
kind
of stuff.
Make me cringe, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the Borges story always comes to my mind, where he meets this young man and he's in a park in Buenos Aires, and then he realizes it's a former self, even though he doesn't like the young man. He's arrogant, but he likes things about him. There's that ambivalence about who you were, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, and what I was realizing in that introductory thing is that you are at least, whatever, if you've lived 60 years, 60,000 different people. And it's that weaving that's in that introduction that tries to figure out all these selves, because what is that line, like, the past isn't even past?
It's the Faulkner line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically all those people, those 60,000 selves, they're always present and bickering with each other. And those are the various aspects that come into play. And having drawn this introduction, I kept finding different drawing styles for each little memory sequence, because no two characters should be drawn in the same style.
Well, you're so good when you do things like when you draw Tubby, you know, even as a kid. Yeah, that's Tubby. That's right out of Little Lulu. I also like the stuff about getting in the comic books to build your own fort and build your own frontier thing. Turns out to be all those things were kind of rooks. You know, it was like they tell you
to order the sea monkeys.
I was just thinking of the sea monkeys. Yeah, the sea monkeys are a perfect example. You order sea monkeys.
More people wanted the sea monkeys, and they were really disappointed that the mama sea monkey didn't have an apron on. It was just a piece of a speck of brine or something, but
and
I didn't go for that.
Also had postage
one.
Stamps from different planets. Do you remember those?
No, I actually didn't.
Jupiter had postage stamps. But boy, you know, reliving this stuff, I was thinking, Art had to go through this again, you know, and the hell planet and your mother's suicide and everything. I mean, didn't you, in a sense, you have more distance now, of course, but all that feeling of worthlessness and all that pain and stuff didn't
come
back? All
the pain came surging back. That's why I say all those selves are not past. They're different selves. And the four-page comic that was made in 72, and this is a collection of work from 72 to 77, that strip about my mother's suicide, which is printed way too small and in a context that doesn't let it stand alone as a part of the Mao's books, when I was starting to look at it and think about it again and see what memories it brought up, because that was the nature of the introductory piece, I found myself doubled over in pain all over again.
Yeah. I mean, it was painful to read. But, of course, you know, there's also this wonderful humor, this gallows humor and dark humor that served you well in your work. One of the things I was surprised about, because I got to know your father through Mao's, is that, you know, he was like my father, used the belt buckle, although you had a standoff with him that was kind of interesting. That actually autobiographical.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like being beaten by my father. It wasn't like child beating the way you'd read about it in criminal court. It was just called child rearing, which you take the child's rear and you do whatever you got to do.
I told Lee Salk once, I used to say, you know, that my father used a belt on us, you know, to mete out punishment. And he said, your father was beastly to do that. I said, no, my father, I felt he was being just. I felt, you know, we were acting iniquitously as young boys could, as young semi-delinquents could.
Well, there's one point when I was like 14 or I don't remember what age.
But you stood up to your old man.
Yeah, where I took my belt off and I was going to do one-on-one with him, and then corporal punishment stopped, and that was important for me.
That was, in fact, very important in terms of, I guess, what you didn't get out of playing softball or something.
Right. All of a sudden, the Y chromosome kicked in. Like on the baseball field, it was sort of like, as I said in that strip, it's like to be some in the 50s, to not play baseball and do it well was to be something lower than a girl, you know.
They called you all those names? Those names that you...
Faggot, Four Eyes, all that stuff, of course. But, that, you know, almost every cartoonist I met, except the few macho ones like Spain Rodriguez, like... We got called Four Eyes and Faggot, like, because we weren't into the mesomorph thing, you know. But for me, as the baseball thing had a lot to do, I found out later, with the fact that I only have one eye, and that meant any ball coming at me didn't exist in space. It just existed as something that hit me in the head. I had no parallax vision. So at least I have now an explanation for why I was a four-eyed faggot, but I just didn't at the time.
Take us back to that whole era, though, of Haight-Ashbury. And, I mean, there must be a lot of nostalgia in you for that period.
I guess, although, you know what? I don't have nostalgia for anything I lived through. My nostalgia goes back to, like, oh, the 1920s, weren't they great? The 30s. And nostalgia stops in 1948 when I'm born. After that, it's just like hurdles to jump through that exist to take me back to moments in the past. And sure, some of those moments in the past were really ones I enjoy reliving in my head. Like, the comic scene was a very vital and exciting place. I had very close friends out here. It felt very familial. You mentioned Bill Griffith, and we were really, really tight in those days. And he was the one person I could really talk with about the kind of new kind of comics I was trying to forge and make that he was interested in as a transplanted East Coaster. Like, my problem with the West Coast cartoonists, like the ones from Texas that settled here, like Gilbert Shelton, who did the fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, I like that Texas crowd of cartoonists a lot, but all we could talk about is beer. There's no other topic of conversation, and like my capacity to talk about beer is used up in about one shot, you know. So with Griffith and a few other artists like Justin Green, Kim Deitch, some others, it was possible to really talk about what comics are at their very, very root when they're not being applied art and made to, like, make you laugh or tell a melodramatic story or something. And those conversations were very important for me in figuring out what kind of a blankety blank I was.
Well, you've made it now, respectability of graphic fiction and all of that. Yeah. But,
so now I have to fight against it. Now I have to say, no, look, it shouldn't get too respectable, folks.
Well, I remember a conversation I had with Harvey Pekar a number of years ago, and he was saying, he was lamenting the loss of underground comics. He was saying that, you know, once the movement died in terms of the Vietnam War and, you know, all of that, civil rights, that underground comics died. And he was
Well, underground comics morphed. They didn't die. Like, look, Harvey's stuff is more visible, available, and everywhere than it ever was back in 1972, and one can be nostalgic for being able to fly under the critical radar the way we did. But there's a trade-off that's actually making right now for an incredibly rich comic scene. I don't remember anything like what's going on in the last 8 years ever happening, even in the history
just
of comics.
Just yesterday got in the mail a graphic representation of the Constitution. I mean, those kinds of things, too.
Well, there's that, and there's, like, literary comics, and there's comics that are, like, really wildly graphic things. The graphic novel section in the bookstore is the fastest growing section in American bookstores in the blue zone. In the red zone, it's religious books.
In fact, there are places in Berkeley where you can, they're just all graphic fiction.
Well, sure, sure. I mean, there were always comic shops, but now they actually have that thing of, like, inviting a new set of eyeballs in. You know, like, unless you were especially hip to the jive, like, you'd didn't go into a comic shop. And now it's just part of, if you're literate, there's this graphic novel section. And under that euphemism, you can read all the comics you want, ranging from reprints to Japanese comics to dark versions of superhero comics that are basically storyboards for movies to really rich works by Dan Clowes and Chris Ware and others that are as demanding as any literature without pictures.
I just saw Will Eisner's Moby Dick recently. I mean, we've got the great classics.
Well, that's you remember the old classics, though, from your
classic
childhood as well.
Books, yeah, they were
that's
wonderful.
An extension of that. What I remember is, like, I was using classic comics in school until I read only Hamlet in classic comics format, and I didn't really know the his farewell soliloquy because it had been reduced down to one balloon in the classic comic, which was farewell. Arg!
Well, there's a lot of popular culture in your story here. I mean, you mentioned Dick Van Dyke, and you say Lewis Carroll still leaves you feeling unhinged, I think is what we're used.
Right.
And I remember also those horror comics, which you have a little kind of tribute to. I mean, they were really scary. They were terrible.
They were,
scary.
And it led to the near demise of my medium when in the early 50s you had these Kefauver crime hearings that included comics as the cause of juvenile delinquency, and the result of it combined with PTA and church comic burnings left a comic code authority, the most draconian code of what could be put into a media that America's ever had, that nearly left comics for dead. Like most of the publishers went out of business. What was left were just some benign, funny animal comics. And
yeah, but I remember the action comics, for example. I mean, you read Superman, and during the McCarthy era, you know, he would be fighting the Red Chinese and, you know, fighting communists and things
Well, sure.
That,
so. That was where America was at the moment. But you also had, like, this guy, Dr. Frederick Wortham, the psychiatrist that brought about these hearings with a book he did on the horrors of comics as a cause of juvenile delinquency. And he describes Superman as a jackbooted crypto-Nazi. Like as an Ubermensch. So you know, this is more than you want to know, but like Frederick Wortham was this German Jew, actually had some interesting aspects to him, and it was like a battle between the Ostjuden, the East Jews, and the German more sophisticated Jews about what would constitute a culture for America.
Why do you think so many Jews became famed cartoonists? I mean, the creators of Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, I mean, they were all Jewish.
And the creator of Mad and those horror comics we're talking about and The Spirit. Yeah, I think it was like comic books were an extension of the rag trade, basically. You know? The people of the book were not considered fit for the higher country club echelon of publishing, but they could become the people of the comic book as an outgrowth of pulps and junk culture because nobody else wanted to do it. It paid badly. And so comic books got populated by that immigrant class the same way 50 years earlier you had a lot of Irish cartoonists making comic strips.
Mad Magazine was your real seminal influence, I guess.
Yeah, that's what ruined my life.
But it was, you capture in Breakdowns the new collection from the early seminal period, you capture that sense of excitement and desire and almost lust to see Mad Magazine, to get it, even at your parents being against it.
Well, yeah, as a very, very young kid, I saw this. I was too young to get the first Mad comic books when they came on the stands, but the first paperback reprints like caught my eye at the lower height of a paperback spinner rack while my mother's shopping in a drugstore. And there was one cover, this thing that looked like Life magazine and had this Basil Wolverton drawing of the most beautiful girl in the world, a girl who has like teeth all over the place, warts everywhere, hair coming out of her nose. And somehow that combined with Life magazine, the most authoritative combination of CNN, C-SPAN, Tom Brokaw, a voice of major mainstream authority being now presented as Life magazine with a Mad logo. That image just blew me away as a kid of 7 years old. And I needed to have it because, as I explain in that little sequence, Mad warped a generation in the Mad American 1950s. It was saying something new. It was saying the media, the whole damn adult world is lying to you, and we here at Mad are part of the media.
You know, you talk about being smitten with Mad at the age of seven. When I was in the fourth grade, there was a kid. I have photographs to prove this. There was a kid in my class, because there were photographs of that class, who was a dead ringer, and I mean a doppelganger for Alfred E. Newman.
And he grew up to be president.
Well, no, he. I mean, and he became kind of a celebrity just because he resembled it. Like, remember Melvin Kosnovsky? You remember that was the other name for Alfred Newman?
Oh, you know, as I say in the punchline of that sequence, I studied Mad the way some kids studied the Talmud. I really pored over those issues. And it really taught me to question and to, like, look at the secret language of comics as well as what's being said. Because, like, Mad used the fact that drawing styles changed, for example, which I just referred to in talking about my own introduction. And it brings you into a kind of postmodernism right away of, like, looking at the language as well as what it's saying.
You you had quite a lot of success with those Wacky Passages and Garbage Pail Kids.
Probably seen by more people than I'll ever see anything else I ever did. They were all between the ages of 6 and 11 and had a quarter that my bubblegum company could wrest out of their sticky fingers if in exchange for passing my mad lessons along.
I was a collector of Garbage Pail Kids. I remember driving around the city of San Francisco and they were all sold out everywhere, you know, looking for Garbage Pail Kids. For her.
When Garbage Pail Kids came out, that's when Mao's first came out. It was the same year. And my publisher was just terrified that I would be known as the person who did them, because they said, it's hard enough to sell a comic book about the Holocaust if they know about Garbage Pail Kids, which are like a subject of fury in newspaper columns at that moment. Like, how dare people give these to their kids? Just like with the comic books 20 years earlier, 30 years earlier. They said, they're just going to be talking about Garbage Pail Jews, and that's the end of your book. So my publisher and Topps, who like to keep us artists anonymous, were very glad that that information that you just put out on the radio now didn't come out in 1986.
Well, let's give a little information. My producer just said, maybe we ought to describe what Garbage Pail Kids were.
Okay. Well, it was at that moment when there were these dolls called Cabbage Patch Kids, and they were dolls that were sort of homely, so that you would want to protect them and adopt them. They were adopted. Yeah, they were babies.
And they
were called Cabbage Patch because found under a cabbage leaf. And they were kind of cloying and annoying to me, but they were a phenomenon. And Topps had a history of doing this kind of post-Mad Comics kind of
undoing. Topps, we should say, are the baseball
cards. That's the baseball card company that did Wacky Packs and Garbage Pail Kids and many, many other items like it. And basically it was, if these homely kids become frighteningly ugly kids that nobody would adopt, but they just put in a garbage can, that's more interesting. So there's one, like a little girl named Leaky Lindsay, looks sort of like a Cabbage Patch kid. We put names underneath so kids could find their friends in their own names to insult them, others, or feel humiliated for the name that they found. Leaky Lindsay has snot. It's not one of those FCC words, or I can say snot.
No, I think
snot. Snot's okay. All right. So
snot's
snot
funny,
coming out of her nose and becoming like a, she's starting to make a cat's cradle, like a string cat's cradle out of it, and it's just dripping everywhere. Or another one called Adam Bomb, who's pressing a little button that he's holding, and the top of his head is blowing up and turning into a mushroom cloud.
We're talking Art Spiegelman, creator of Garbage Pail Kids, and has a new book out called Breakdowns, and lives now in the shadow of Mao's, as you say. Maybe we can talk a bit about that.
Okay.
But in the meantime, I'm going to invite our listeners to join us. You can, we're really talking about comics and the whole history of comics here, because this is a man who has gone through the incarnations of underground comics and has come out to be probably one of our greatest cartoonists and storytelling cartoonists, living or dead. We welcome your calls, and you can join us now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Some of you have memories from this era, too, of underground comics in San Francisco. Certainly welcome that. Our toll-free number, again, 866-733-6786. That'll work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join the program. You can also send an email, and the email address is simply forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and comic artist Art Spiegelman, best known for his Holocaust narratives, Mao's and Mao's 2, here with us in studio. And he will be at Opera Plaza at Books Incorporated this evening at 7 p.m. doing a slideshow and who knows what else, maybe song and dance, horse and pony. Tell us, though, a little bit about Breakdowns in terms of, again, well, the beginning of Mao's, the genesis of it.
Okay, because I think, as you're right, most people know me through that Mao's graphic novel, in quotes, is what was my crossover hit, like a blues musician who made it in the white world. But basically, it started as a three-page comic in an underground comic called Funny Aminals, where the only requirement was do whatever you want, but just use anthropomorphic characters. Crumb did the lead story about two little foxes who chase this big-breasted and big-legged chicken lady around and get her to come up to their apartment, and then they eat her, not in any FCC-unapproved way, but, hey, they're foxes, she's a chicken. So in that context, I did this thing called Mouse about my parents' lives in the death camps using cats as Nazis and mice as Jews. And that was really out of sync in some ways in terms of subject matter with where most of the underground comics things that I'd been doing and others were working on could be. And it really was the first comic where I felt I found my own voice. It still looked like an underground comic, a lot of cross-hatching and extra visual information, but it was the beginnings of something moving me elsewhere. And as a result, it's the first piece in this book that I did in 78 called From Mouse to Now, as if everybody in the world knew Mouse, because for me it was a landmark. And Now, of course, was 1978, before I even started the long book in 1978, when I turned 30, I had this vision I could do a comic book that needed a bookmark, a really long comic book. That was the only real conscious reason to make Mouse the book. And for that, I used all the lessons I learned in that those strips I did between 72 and 77, some of which were very autobiographical strips with very strange visualizations like the one about my mother's death, and other strips that I can only describe now as postmodern deconstructionist comics, except, man, were those words a million miles away from San Francisco in 1970s. So that combination of deconstructionist things that worked against the narrative, which is what a lot of the so-called experimental pieces in the 78 book were, found an audience of exactly 10, maybe, when the book came out. It landed with such a resounding thud, my large-size, hardcover, permanent art book of comics, and it made me realize if I wanted to keep doing comics, I had to return to the notion of telling a story rather than breaking a story down.
Well, you were trying all, I mean, clearly you were experimenting with, in fact, German Expressionism played a very formidable role early on in your development.
Yeah, and Cubism, you know, that
and
thing
Cubism,
of taking things
yeah,
apart.
Right.
So in making the Mouse books, I was trying to be as narrative as possible and make all of the lessons I'd learned about how comics work just serve the notion of, man, it takes no skill or knowledge. You can read a comic book. Just start, come on in, and you'll get to the finish line with me. So with the Mouse books, I found many people who had never picked up a comic book before, but they found themselves easily moving through that. This thing, both the old book of experimental comics and its introduction, requires a lot slower a read. It's just, I think there are more sophisticated eyeballs now than there were in 78.
And we should mention you got a kid's book out now, too. Just
that's
before
right.
Before we go to our callers here.
Yeah, well, what's really strange is that this book, Breakdown, since it's from the underground comics days, has a very clear adults-only label on the front, and it means it. It's not for the 14-year-old kid who'd read Mouse for school, which happens a lot now, but it's really for sophisticated adults, not just because they have to be able to look at things that at first blush literally look like pornography, but because of the kind of density of idea that's in it. It's an adult book. And at the same moment, I have a book genuinely, I swear, designed for 5 or 6 years old kids that's not subversive, except not like Garbage Pail Kids, but a comic that's not subversive unless educating children is subversive. Because, you know, the last 30 years have been involved in dismantling our educational system. And kids have to learn to read if they're going to learn to combat the misinformation that comes at them. And to that end, Françoise, my wife, who, as you noted in the break, is the art editor of The New Yorker, took on this impossible task, self-publishing in the 21st century. It's insane. And it's because it's a new category of book that doesn't exist. Easy readers in comics format. Not just a book you could read to your kid, but a book the kid could read to himself. And so this was as much an art of limitation as my deconstructionist comics. But what it is using simple language that you'd learn in your first grade and using repetition and using sometimes rhyming balloons to you take advantage of the fact that comics can really help you learn to read. My kids learned to read by destroying my comic book collection. I learned to read from comics.
How old are your kids now?
Oh, now they're fine readers. My daughter's an English major finishing up life at Yale, and my son is just at that moment of battering his way into one college or another as a senior in high school.
I feel like I know them from your last book, from the No Tower book. Let me go to the callers, and we'll start off, Michael, with you. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Welcome to the program.
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to say, Mr. Siegelman, I hope you don't get tired of people saying how much the book Mouth meant to them and how important it was.
Oh, well, thanks. No, I mean, it's always... it's this double-edged sword where I'm really grateful for it. And then, as Michael said, there's a sequence in the new book that has me living under this 500-foot monument to my father, like not able to find a way out of its shadows, which is the other side of it. And yet, I'm really grateful that a book I did remains in print and vital and used and appreciated and seemingly loved. I'm not used to being loved that way. Like
well,
I said, it was a crossover hit.
I also wanted to ask if you'd heard about Spain Rodriguez's biography of Che in graphic novel form.
Oh, yeah, it's got a blurb by me on the back.
Oh, yeah.
I never blurb, but I did it for Spain.
Yeah, okay. I thought, when you were talking about, you know, teaching and using graphic novels, it's a really good, you know, the history book. I think, you know, from Mouse and from all of these different graphic novels that are showing people the new way to reach an audience, and it's a new way to kind of get into their minds and show them stuff that they didn't know or hadn't seen before.
Yeah, you're right about that. I never thought I'd do this, but I did a textbook, which is coming out in a couple months from McGraw-Hill, with a professor at Berkeley named Maggie Sokolik, and there are whole sections of graphic fiction. And the publisher is very excited about the fact that we made this decision to use to include graphic fiction along with essays.
Well, you know, it's a done deal at this point. It's amazing. In the last 8 years, comics are in bookstores, they're in libraries, there's shows of them in museums. Schools are embracing these things as a way of passing along information, like our caller just said. And it's like comics as a serious medium has happened as the world in the last 8 years has turned to sludge and become a lot less serious elsewhere. I'm just afraid that comics may have like sucked up all the seriousness allowed. And I don't know, pigs with lipstick are running around in the real world rather than in comic books.
It's Diamond Dave. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, Art, really good to hear your voice again. I hear another fast talker. Spain Rodriguez, living here in town. And, you know, I remember most of that whole crew, and I think he helped bring it all together was Dave Sheridan, who's now fortunately passed, you know?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, it was an amazing scene at that time.
Actually,
yeah, I was impressed.
Dave, you know, did you know Ken Jacobs at all?
Well, Ken's on the East Coast.
The filmmaker Ken Jacobs?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the name that's singled out in Art's work, in his new work. I mean, he was kind of a father figure, in fact, wasn't he?
I had a number of fathers of one kind or another, yeah. And Ken was there to, like, tell me, you know, it's okay to think of what you're doing as a kind of art as opposed to, like, having to be part of that gutter culture. And it was actually opening me up to, like, painting, film. The closest that came out here was, like, cartoonists like, I think you'll know, Dave, like Moscoso and Rick Griffin. It was like when it moved toward art, it moved toward surrealism. And cubism's a bit harder. And so like being beckoned to learn how to look at that was an important part of my growing up with Ken mentoring on that front.
Well, Ken was a good friend of Lenny Bruce and had that connection. In fact, wasn't his first one of his first films a Lenny Bruce routine?
I doubt it. He was a good friend of Jack Smith, who's really important in the kind of sainthood and pantheon of the Castro neighborhood, you know, like with a film called Blonde Cobra. But I don't think he did a Lenny Bruce thing as far as maybe, but I really doubt it.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Well, this is at North Beach back in the 50s. But anyway, what I want to mention.
I'm sorry. I didn't know you had something else, Dave. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to mention to you, I just happened to be holding my hand. I was at the library a couple of days ago, and I'm holding my hand. I just want to read the first couple in the back. It says, Bravo for the proliferation of graphic novels, which has freed us from the tyranny of superhuman comics and given us such classics as Mouse, Persepolis, and now Sharon Rudolph's A Dangerous Woman. This is a graphic press out of the life of Emma Goldman. And this is written by Trina Robbins, who, of course, was one of the first of the women comic writers of the modern time.
Oh, so there's now a graphic biography of Emma Goldman.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave.
I've seen it. But you know, what's interesting to me is, yeah, comics can do this thing of transmitting hard information, but it's important to know that comics is really a large medium. So it can include, superheroes bashing each other's heads in, as well as educational material. But what's really interesting to me is it's wide open, and the things that are the crossover hit it's made easy are the ones that carry useful information. It's like the nonfiction side of the bestseller list because, oh, it's good for you if you read this. You'll get information. But the idea that comics are an art, that they actually give an experience and can function with lowbrow humor as well as very, very intricate storytelling that doesn't have any medicinal use value, like, Junior, if you want to learn about Emma Goldman or the Holocaust, read this. It's easy to read. It's a much bigger field than that. And there's some like strange tributaries floating through those bookstores now that they've embraced graphic novels in the libraries that are even wider than just nonfiction comics as information.
Talking again with Art Spiegelman. His new book is Breakdowns. And our next caller is Lear. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Art and Michael, hi. Art, I'm a huge fan of your work, and I'm just really honored that I can talk to you.
Oh, thanks, Lear.
I'm 37 years old, so I came to RAW relatively late. I happened to, in my freshman year of college, I was fortunate enough to get the final issue of it when it came out, but. Just like many American boys growing up, you know, I was sort of weaned on superhero comics. And then at a point in my, you know, young adulthood and maturity, I kind of left that behind and then really got turned on to alternative comics and underground comics. But what I really noticed is that there came a point in superhero comics, once I had stopped reading them, but I noticed like the artist Frank Miller and his Batman series, The Dark Knight Returns, where it really sort of adopted, for me, what I saw is like more of that sort of aesthetic of the underground comics. And I was just curious to hear your comments on that.
Well, The Dark Knight certainly got darker, but I always was suspicious of it. I understand that this is the real superhighway of where comics travel, is that superhero thing.
Yeah.
But I thought that The Dark Knight was basically a fable that like ratified the Reagan years as this aging vigilante. And as a result, I saw it as maybe using some of the cartoon language that developed in underground comics and the darkness that came with underground comics, but at its core, I was very suspicious of it as kind of meta right-wing propaganda.
Well, there you go, Lear. Thank you. By the way, did you know, here's a listener, Stephen, who sends the following email about the blankety blanks in comics, officially called a Grawlix?
But this must be Mort Walker's word, but I'll use it now when people
Mort
ask
Walker
me. I forgot
Beetle
that.
Bailey.
Yeah, he put out a lexicon of fribbits, brolics, referring to the sweat marks, and he gave names to all these things. It was kind of funny. And I remember reading that, but I didn't remember the one he had christened this thing. And what is Grawlix?
He does say it was coined by Beetle Bailey cartoonist Mort Walker.
Yeah.
Grawlix, noun, a string of typographical symbols used, especially in comic strips, to represent an obscenity or swear word.
All right. Grawlix. Next time somebody asks me, I'll tell them.
There's a web link here if you're interested. Here's Annie who writes, I was a young kid in the early 70s. I spent a lot of time reading my brother's Mad magazines. As a young adult, I realized it was through Mad that I had received much of my cultural education. I never watched the movies, but I had read all of Mad's satires. Much of the political history of the time I learned through the satire in the magazine, found even in that folding back page.
I agree, and that those, you know, that Mad legacy was a really important one that like lives today through The Simpsons. I think most kids are exposed to the rest of our culture by the references that happen on The Simpsons. And then as you get a bit older, you're ready for The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, which basically give you this fractured funhouse reverse mirror of the horror show of The Daily News. And I'm sure that there's a lot of kids in college that are actually getting brought up to speed on what's happening, not by what they see on CNN, but what they see with Jon Stewart. It's a definite continuation of that Mad thing.
Unfortunately, a lot of young people get their news exclusively through either Jon Stewart or Jay Leno or David Letterman.
You know, well, with Jon Stewart, I think it's better than getting your news from Fox. Those people come out better educated according to about what's happening in the day's news. Seriously, in a survey that was made of answering current event questions, Fox News listeners, lower score than The Daily Show listeners.
Remember all those magazines that were imitated, like Cracked. They were
I had a giant collection of that stuff. I loved it so much that I had Cracked, Frenzy, Loco, Frantic.
But none of them really ever made it. I mean, really.
Well, no, it's just like everything brings in its wake. You know, like now that The Dark Knight is a popular movie, the Batman movie, there's going to be 500 superhero movies coming if they can afford to make movies in the new economy. And maybe one of them will be good, but they were just sort of like the ripples. I just needed more Mad than I could get every month, so I just got every possible parody that came along.
And we're going to go to a caller in Charleston, South Carolina. Jonathan, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just, first off, wanted to thank Mr. Spiegelman for, you know, the work he's done. And I think In the Shadow and the Towers is an amazing book. And it's one of those things where I got it as a gift about a year ago, and I sort of flip through it every once in a while. It's just like it's an overwhelming work of art. I just wanted to sort of thank him for it.
Thanks for saying that. I'm grateful to hear it, because that's another book that I felt like it wasn't exactly a graphic novel. It was like 10 by 14 baby board book. Maybe it's a graphic novelty, but it was made to be like a portfolio that could be delivered as a book in a bookstore, and I'm glad you're receiving it that way. That's swell.
And I thank you for the call, Jonathan. By the way, if you'd like to join us with Art Spiegelman, you're welcome to do that. And again, he'll be at Opera Plaza Books Incorporated tonight in San Francisco at 7. But he's here right now, so if you want to talk to him, it's an excellent opportunity to do so, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius Satellite. It's toll-free 866-733-6786. That's the number for your calls. Or you can email us forum@kqed.org. Mike joining us from Concord. Good morning.
Good morning. I just finished reading The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
All right.
You may have talked about this at the beginning because I missed the beginning of the show, but I was wondering if you had any comments on it and how much you think the Cavalier character was modeled after you.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't modeled after me, although I think that Faustian deal that somehow we've been almost referring to several times in the course of this show of, well, you know, if comics are going to survive in another century, they've got to achieve the respectability that allows this hunchback, twisted dwarf of a retarded medium into the salon. It's a Faustian arrangement. You get the credibility, but you lose the energies, perhaps, of that kind of unmediated id culture that was comic books in an earlier time. And I think I do represent that kind of movement toward, for better and for worse, toward a more reputable comic book in libraries and schools. And I think that's that element of things certainly was part of what exists in that Cavalier character. But I think it's rather clearly Will Eisner that he has in mind.
Actually, in fact, Michael Chabon, of course, lives out here.
Right.
And, I thought it was a wonderful novel.
No, I'm just the druggist in that book. It's called Spiegelman Drugs, where the kid goes to get his comic books.
In fact, in Yiddish Policeman's Union, there's a Krasny store, so we both.
Oh, we can open up businesses in the same mall of Shadenland.
What did you think of Cavalier and Clay?
Oh, I was very impressed with how much he was able to pull together, and it was just a sign of the times that he was able to like make this thing about. Really, comics becoming a medium worthy of a novel and
a highly
and
literate
really came
novel.
Together. A very intensely woven one.
And he, like you, Michael Chabon was really a very intensely comic book centric kid. You know, loving comic books as a kid and just eating them up, so to speak.
And that whole thing about the Kiefhoffer, which you referred to,
it was a traumatic moment.
That
era,
I didn't know about.
That Kiefhoffer moment really was a traumatic moment in the history of comics, so it comes up often for all of us.
It was the investigation for those listeners. That
it was comic books as the cause of juvenile delinquency and caused the near death of the medium,
Thank you, Mike. Good to hear from you, and let's hear from some more of our callers. Susan, morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is Susan from Winters.
Right. Go ahead. Speak to us.
Yeah. My daughter is very interested in comics, and she came up with an idea the other day about comic book heroes do not go to war anymore. She was looking at an old Wonder Woman comic, and it was very much about World War II and the Japs and the Germans. And
I think that word is not an FCC word, but Japs is one of those words that makes me cringe. You guys say Japanese.
Well, but the whole comic
but they were called Japs back then. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just it was terrible. The racial stereotypes. It was really other races were villainous, even races living within this country that were non-white.
Yeah, although comics just work with a language of stereotypes. That's literally the language of comics, you know?
Yeah.
Tough guy, big jaw, brainy guy, big forehead, that kind of thing.
No, but she's right. You go back to the old comics and the racial stereotypes are
absolutely
so extreme. Whether it's people of color, whether it's Jews, I mean, it doesn't matter.
Well, it's just the norm of American culture.
That's
was
exactly
it's our
right.
hate-filled heritage. So even the spirit, who you were kind of half evoking when we talked about Will Eisner, has a sidekick who's like looks stupider than any monkey. He's like one of those minstrel-faced black kids, you know?
Yeah.
Was part of the norm. Sure. I'm sorry, but somehow we derailed
you. Well, no, you're concerned about your daughter, huh?
Well, no, I'm just wondering about her comment that comic book heroes no longer go to war. Is it because the people that write comics, they've changed?
I think it's just not true. Like, comics do go to war. It's just you have to look at the comic books coming out now. There's a number of comics.
G.I. Joe?
Well, maybe it's G.I. Joe. I know there's something called Pride of Baghdad that just came out. There's a graphic novel about the war in Iraq. And certainly Joe Sacco, one of my favorite cartoonists, who grew up as a journalist, who the only comic book artist I know with a journalism degree, spending a lot of time in the West Bank and doing a book called Palestine, spending time in Yugoslavia doing a graphic novel called Safe Area Garajda. And these are very serious works that take place in the war zones that he was able to live in.
Thank you, Susan. We'll go next to Jason. Morning, Jason.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Several years ago, my friend's father handed me a political comic book, which I thought was the best comic book I ever read, and they recently made it into a movie, V for Vendetta. And I know it's been out a while. I was wondering if you could comment on it.
Well, it's by Alan Moore. It's a good anarchist comic book. I liked it better than Alan Moore does. He, I think, cringes at all of his things being turned into films because he and I do share an interest in comic book language, which isn't the same as a storyboard for a movie on paper. And I think that from what I heard, like he was not I don't think he even went to see the V for Vendetta movie. And he's unhappy that they're now making a Watchmen film as well. Although I thought it was a good one of those dystopian movies that struck a blow for anarchists everywhere. That was fine by me.
Well, weren't you from the get-go opposed to Maus being made into a movie?
Yeah, I still don't want it. I've been getting more and more offers, especially ever since Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis film. They've become hot and heavy where I can do it any way I want. You understand you can get final cut art? I said, yeah, but I'm not a mile. I'm a comic book artist, you know?
Well, in fact, was it Errol Morris who...
Errol Morris was willing to sign on because my wisecrack in the years before computer graphic imaging made it real easy to do anything you wanted, when this producer got hold of me and just insisted and said, like, so look, if you were going to make Maus a movie, I know you don't want to, but if you were going to, how would you do it? And just to get rid of her, I explained, I thought we should use real mice. And that made her gulp. She went away. And Errol Morris got in touch and said, he's on.
You know, the fact there's a Monty Python bit about real mice. You know the bit I'm talking about?
No, actually.
They're meeting at in a kind of subterranean, hidden way, a group of people who obviously have some addiction, and they're in a group, and the addiction is that they meet with mice and that they dance with mice and that they do all these things. I mean, it's
silly. One that got away. I didn't know that episode.
Yeah, I mean, you do keep up with. You really keep up with cartoons, and you keep up with popular culture in ways that really are...
Well, you know,
amazing,
like the Pythons include Terry Gilliam, obviously, right? And Terry Gilliam got his start from Harvey Kurtzman working for a magazine after Mad called Help. And that's, in fact, how John Cleese and Terry Gilliam met. They were in a photo comic that Harvey Kurtzman, creator of Mad, wrote for Help magazine.
Let me get another caller on here in Severo.
Trivia morning.
Yeah, well, it's good trivia. Go ahead, Severo.
Hi there.
Hi.
We are familiar with your Maus books and enjoy them enormously, but don't generally read comics. And a couple of years ago, I think a friend of ours gave us a book called Gemma Bovary by Posy Simmons.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know that book? And
oh, absolutely. Yeah, she's a cartooning national treasure in London who appears in The Guardian and Independent, I think, doing these very literate comics. At this point, there's so much, it's hard even for me who like knows and cares about all this stuff to keep up with the breadth of what comes out. And the Gemma Bovary book did come out but didn't really find the audience here that it found in France and England.
Yeah, I wondered also what you think about the relationship between this and the Flaubert. This, of course, is a wonderful work in itself, but it's, of course, not the same thing as the Flaubert. And I
wonder it's an updating of Flaubert into Emma Bovary and her husband being yuppies buying their country home in France, right?
Right, right. I wonder if it's a distinct thing completely. I wonder if people who read this will then read the Flaubert.
Or vice versa. I probably think this one is not like that thing we were describing with Mad, where read the parody of Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven and then go find the original kids. It's more like it assumes almost that one has read the Flaubert novel and then is kind of matching up the changes and differences in this new work.
Right.
Yeah, some of these graphic novels are really ambitious. I saw one on Remembrance of Things Past, you know.
Multiple volumes. Yeah. That was a direct adaptation that's still going on, I think, because that's kind of a big book.
Gone almost endlessly. Here's Gabriel, who writes, I want to thank you for Maz and Maz 2, my first introduction to the oppression of other races. I grew up in a Latino-centric area, and as I adjusted to the Bay Area growing up, your work opened my eyes beyond my cultural roots. Those are always wonderfully validating kinds of comments.
I'm sorry, because in the introduction here, I explained how the first three-page mouse didn't come out about trying to deal with my Jewish heritage. It was an insight I got from the aforementioned Ken Jacobs in a film class showing an animated cartoon saying, look, Mickey Mouse is just Al Jolson with big ears, that same white lip thing. And I was going to do a strip about blacks in America with Ku Klux Cats and things like that. So I think that response actually gets down to the secret tributaries and rivers underneath the Mao's work that's so specifically about what happened to my family.
They've always been bold in taking on those political things, too. I remember the famous New Yorker cover with I Have a Dream and Martin Luther King's. in fact, speaking about your politics, here's David from Berkeley who says, thanks, Art, for your Mao's book. My dad was a Holocaust survivor. A Mao's-type book on the most disastrous presidency since Reconstruction seems warranted. Are you contemplating anything like this? I think Oliver Stone has tried to do that, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where it's moved now. No, I think at this point there's no reason for comic artists to take on Bush because it's beating finally a dead horse, and I'm glad to beat him. But it's more important to deal with the new morphing of the monster into the McCain-Palin stuff that we're dealing with just to be able to get back into a reality-based universe after a few months.
Let me get you back to that New Yorker cover with seconds left here. Maybe describe it for listeners because I don't want to sound cryptic.
The one
that they rejected.
Well, they reject many. That one appeared on the cover of The Nation, and it was on Martin Luther King Day, him saying, I have a dream, the banner underneath saying, I have a dream, and it was basically Bush surrounded by his great black friends, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. So this was somehow the dream turned inside out. And
the nightmare.
The New Yorker wouldn't touch it.
Glad you've been with us.
Oh, glad to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me again.
Art Spiegelman will be at Books Incorporated in San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m. Always a pleasure to talk to him and pleasure to be here with you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about Forum or what you hear on Forum or what you like or don't like or who you'd like to hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.